This Is Actually Happening features real experiences that often include traumatic events. Please consult the show notes for specific content warnings on each episode and for more information about support services.
Whenever your mind can't deal with such a traumatic event, it just kind of shuts down. It just got too hurtful to think of him in the ground and me still alive. I couldn't understand the meaning in it.
From Wondery, I'm Whit Misseldine. You are listening to This Is Actually Happening. Episode 213. What if they were murdered trying to protect you? This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by Airbnb. I travel often, and when I'm away, my home never sits empty. I've been an Airbnb host for over 10 years, and it's always been the perfect way to make a little extra money to help supplement my travels while I'm gone. You can even plan around events, like maybe there's a big tournament coming to town and lots of fans will be visiting. You could Airbnb your home or extra room and make some extra money. Your home or spare room might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the home of storytelling. In addition to an incredible selection of audiobooks, you'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive Audible originals from top celebrities, renowned experts, and exciting new voices in audio. Currently, I'm listening to Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran after seeing the film and wanting to know more about the story. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. That's audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkeri that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've ever heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
I was born 1968. I was thrown into a typical middle class family at that time. One sister who was 21 months older than me. We grew up mostly on a block that was old people. We didn't really have a lot of kids around to play with, so we had to rely on each other for entertainment. My dad was a welder, you know, being at work during the day, my mom staying at home with us. Both of my parents had mean tempers, heavy hands. I relied heavily on emotional support from my sister. I remember a big fight that my parents had, and we hid in the closet. And I can remember my mom yelling at us to pack our things we were leaving. That was the first fight that I remember my dad actually slapping my mom. You know, it seemed like my dad after that became kind of the bad guy. This is the person who is supposed to love and care for me and watch over me, and I'm afraid of him. My dad was kind of a weird guy. He would walk into like a convenience store, and he would stand at the entrance He would just kind of case the joint, is what he called it. I guess that was his way of making sure that the premises were secure. But I just kind of felt a little awkward. He always had to sit in a restaurant where he could face the door. I was probably in the first or second grade. My dad lost his job and got laid off. So he had to find another job, and he ended up being a security guard. So he became kind of absent. There was less of a shadow, a dark shadow over the home. It was like when he was gone, we were good. Sometimes I would be sitting in the front room with my mom watching television. And if she saw my dad pull up, she'd say, just go to your room. Don't know what kind of mood he is in. So in case he's in a bad mood. So I learned to hide in my bedroom. Just the fear of my dad, this looming presence. So I kind of learned to hide, to escape from things that were hard to face. My mom told me that I was an insecure child. I think that's where it came from, was seeking to be accepted or having that void filled that, you know, my dad couldn't. I don't feel like I could rely on people in my life. Just having that fear of my dad and also not being able to make friends very easily. It kind of caused me to be shy in ways, but then also I remember trying to be this funny, goofy kid that made people laugh, you know, and that's what I liked. I can remember my parents taking us to church. One of my early memories of church was that I got saved. I was probably about 6 years old because I saw all my peers doing this, so I wanted to be included. One of the things for me was I found out that people were mean at a young age also. My mom was obese. I found out that kids would point and laugh, that they would tease me if they saw my mom, and that would be like another tool that they could use against me. So I really got embarrassed about going places with my mom and my friends seeing my mom. I was in fifth grade. I was about 10 years old. My mom went back to work, and that's when the dynamics changed. This is whenever my dad started to getting abusive. It went beyond just mental abuse to, like, you know, you don't do anything right. You can't do anything good. We clean our rooms. It wasn't good enough. None of our friends were good enough. I started this paper route whenever I was probably about 11 years old. So every day after school, I had to come home and wrap these newspapers and walk my paper route. One time that I think I was a few minutes late, and he got mad at me because I wasn't doing it quick enough and I was already late. And the next thing I know, he's got me in a chokehold. And I can remember thinking, you know, I'm going to throw up or pass out. He finally let go of my neck and then, you know, told me to hurry up and get these done. I was probably between 10 and 11. My mom found out she was pregnant again. And this was very unexpected. And so my dad just blamed her for the whole thing, that this was not his kid, that this had to have been somebody else's. And things between them started to get worse. I was introduced to smoking. Girls would hide in the bathrooms in between classes and smoke. And pretty soon I went into popping pills. And popping pills made me feel good. I also learned that I could lose weight. And, you know, growing up with a father who makes jabs and put downs at a mom who is very overweight, it makes you realize that it's not something that I wanted to be. And I got to where I would just starve myself. I would take these pills and I wouldn't eat. I can remember me and my sister being in kind of a competition of who could be the skinniest. And that for me was a way, I guess, to also escape my dad. One of the guys that I was really interested in at school, his name was Donnie. I kind of invited him over while my dad was gone. I was probably about 12 or 13. We were just kind of, you know, making out a little bit, talking. And then the next thing I know, my dad's pulling up in the front yard and my heart just sunk. I stood there thinking, we're caught, you know, he's going to kill me. He had me standing in the backyard explaining where I was with Donnie. And the next thing I know, he punched me in the face so hard that I fell back against the ground. I mean, I just crumbled to the ground. And I think I might have gone unconscious for a few seconds. The next thing I know, he's picking me up by my foot. So I'm hanging out upside down, just dangling. And he drops me to the ground. And he tells me, now pick yourself up and go inside and clean up. I mean, because I was covered with dirt after he's dragging me all over the backyard. I got to where I hated my dad so much. Like the hate was just overwhelming. And I sometimes dreamt of ending him. I relied heavily on drugs and alcohols to cope with all this stuff that was just falling apart in my life. I was also kind of pressured into sex at a very young age. In the girls' bathroom, they would talk about the boys that they were with the night before. You know, that just sounded like something I could do to be included in that conversation, because I felt like a lot of times I was an outcast. I feel like whenever I hit junior high, everything that I did was a cry for help. And not having that circle of friends that I could really rely on, not being the popular girl, I started thinking of suicide. Like, who would really miss me? At that time, I didn't feel like anybody would. I was down at this neighbor's house, and I was taking a knife, and I had just barely cut my wrist. I thought I could do something that drastic, you know, just finish the job. There was another time whenever I was in the ninth grade that I kind of arranged my mom to discover me, and I put on my ninth grade prom dress, and I took a bunch of mixture of pills, drank a bunch of NyQuil, and laid out on the bed and passed out. And the next thing I remember is her waking me up, asking me, "What did you take?" She called this poison control center, and I had to take that stuff that makes you throw up. It was heavily on my mind, like, what would I do to end my life? It wasn't so much that I wanted to go through the action, but I wanted people to know that I was thinking about it, because I didn't feel like I had a purpose for being here. I didn't feel like I had any parental guidance or support, because my parents going through divorce, I hardly saw my dad. It was like, I think, every other weekend. By the time I was 16 years of age, I dropped out. I told my mom, I said, I'm not getting anything out of school. I don't want to go anymore. And so she signed me out of school and I dropped out.
This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now.
Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It was April of 1986. I had dropped out of school. My sister and her fiance at the time, Johnny, had moved into a house with two roommates, Robert and Robin, and they were planning to get married in August. I can remember going over there quite often and drinking and partying with them. July 3rd was one of those days where I went over there. You know, we partied quite a bit that night. July 4th, we started our festivities early. Robert's friends, Virgil, and his cousin, Forrest, had come over midday, mid-morning, and we ended up going over to this swimming pool. Virgil, I believe he had already started drinking and a little obnoxious. He was throwing the pool furniture around, which got us kicked out. His cousin, Forrest, was very quiet, very reserved, hardly said anything. But he just gave me kind of an uneasy feeling at that time. Once we got removed from the swimming pool, we went down on Riverside and watched fireworks. We went back. It was probably about midnight. I can remember continuing to drink. I know that everybody was kind of drifting off to, you know, their bedrooms to go to sleep. This friend from down the street had joined at some point, and his name was Gary. I can remember him kind of hitting on me a couple of times. He was divorced from his wife. He talked about his little boy. I remember at some point we went to the store to get some more beer. And when we went into the house, Forrest was laying on the couch. His cousin, Virgil, had left and everybody else had gone to bed. So it was me and Gary and Forrest that remained up. I think Gary was gonna take off, and then Forrest said, well, you guys got some beer, let's drink some beer. And so we ended up over at the dining room table and we sat there and had conversation. Forrest seemed pretty reserved and quiet up to that point. That was the first time that he had really been talkative. Forrest had pulled me away from Gary a few times. And he kind of came on to me saying, you know, you remind me of my sister. I feel really close to you like my sister. He did try to kiss me a couple of times at that point. He would move in to kiss me and I would turn or kind of put my hand up and I'd tell him, okay, it's cool. You know, at that point, I really got uneasy about him. Forrest wanted us to drive out to the lake. Gary kind of whispered to me, he said, I really don't feel good about this guy. He said, you're more than welcome to come down to my apartment. No strings attached. I'll sleep on the couch. You can have my bed. I just don't feel good about leaving you here by yourself with him. You know, I said, sure, that sounds good to me, because I kind of wanted to get away from him. We were getting up to leave, and we just kind of paused for a minute, and he was standing with his back against the living area facing me, and I just happened to glance over Gary's shoulder, and I just remember seeing Forrest charging across the living room into the dining room with his hand raised up. And I didn't see what he had in his hand. But the next thing I know, he swung it down at the back of Gary's head. And he clobbered Gary on the back of the head. He put it down on the table. What I saw then was a hammer. Gary just kind of crumbled to the floor. And Forrest grabs me by the throat and was pulling me into the kitchen, which was right around the corner from there. And it just, my whole thought was that Gary was hurt. And it didn't even dawn on me that he didn't care. I just kept on thinking, Forrest, you got to stop doing this. Gary's hurt. We got to check on Gary. It amazed me at the time how easily he moved me with just his hand on my throat. At that time, I could hardly talk. I mean, I was more like squeezing words out. And I remember slapping at his hand, trying to get his hand off of me. And he just felt so strong. He punched me in the face. And so I was kind of dazed. And at that point, I just felt like I was going to pass out. I felt like it was my dad all over again from the time that he had taken me into the backyard, that just that punch in the face so hard. I was confused. I was scared to death because I knew that he was either going to rape me or kill me or both. I had to figure out some way to get away from him. He was so strong and so big. And the way that he moved me into the kitchen and then shoved me up against this cabinet and just laid against me with his body weight, like this guy was over 6 foot and 300 pounds easily. I slapped at him. I was trying hard to fight against him, and there was hardly anything that I was doing that was helping the cause. You know, I was hoping that somebody would come around the corner and help me out. And then Forrest brought a knife up to my face that he got out of this butcher block that was right next to us. And he said, I want you. I remember him punching me a few times. It seemed like he was hitting me to make me unconscious. I can remember making some noises like maybe I was hollering. I yelled his name a few times, just trying to get him to say something else. Then Johnny comes around the corner, and I thought, okay, he's going to save me. I'm going to be okay. He reaches out, and he grabs Forrest's hand, and he says, hey, man, be cool. And whenever he brings it down, Forrest just plunged a knife into his stomach. And I can remember seeing that Johnny's look. It was just almost like he disconnected. And Forrest just drug that knife across his midsection, and then it just came out the other side. All I can remember Johnny doing is grabbing his stomach and walking back out of the kitchen. The next thing I know, I'm shoving Forrest as hard as I possibly could. And I ran after Johnny. I didn't even think about Gary anymore. I just had to get away from Forrest. And as I got to Robert's room, Robert is standing outside the room saying, what just happened? I just followed Johnny. I didn't say anything to Robert. I was in such a panic. And I think my mind was just trying to deal with the whole situation, and it just shut down. Like, I could not think any logical thought past that point, just trying to make sense of what just happened. Johnny had just laid down on Robert's bed, and I grabbed him by the hand as hard as I could. I jerked him into the bathroom and propping Johnny up on this toilet and trying to get him to stay, and he was non-responsive. He was just holding his stomach. His eyes were just kind of rolling around in his head. I kept on grabbing his face and saying, "Johnny, you're going to be okay. We're going to be okay." And I kept on trying to shove his intestines back in his stomach. And I kept on thinking, if I can just get them to stay, you know, he'll be all right. I can remember my sister coming up and knocking at the door, and she's almost like whispering. I had to get up close to the door to hear what she was saying. I was like, "Is Forrest still out there?" And she said, "No, he's gone. He went out the back door." So I unlocked the door and I let her in. I went out to the dining room, and Gary was still laying on the floor, and Robert was calling for the police. So I picked up the hammer that Forrest had hit Gary with, and I started hitting stuff. I just started freaking out. It was like it was finally coming to reality what just happened. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be safe, but I was angry. I think that's whenever I was able to let loose of my anger that this happened. The police show up, and I had the hammer still in my hand. And one of the police officers said, "You've got to put the hammer down." By the time the police got there and they got me to settle down and they got me to put the hammer down, I went into just crying, just pure shock. I went over to Gary and I rolled him over, and it looked like he looked at me, but then his eyes just kind of rolled back in his head. And the police officer that was standing next to him said, "Ma'am, you're not going to be able to do anything for him." As I got up, I put my hand next to his head, and it was a puddle of blood. We stayed there, actually, until the ambulance showed up and loaded up Johnny and took him to the hospital, and then the police took us downtown and took statements. I was kind of afraid that we would be in trouble for some reason. Maybe because underage drinking or whatever, but I was still very numb and tired. I hadn't slept, so I was still going on pure adrenaline. We went to the hospital. At that time, Johnny's mom and his stepdad had come up there, and I think at first everybody was kind of afraid to approach me, so I didn't talk about it a whole lot. They had been able to take Johnny into an emergency surgery. I remember just thinking that Johnny was going to be okay, that he was going to pull through. They tried to find his source of bleeding. He was bleeding internally pretty bad. I don't even remember any more of July 5th. I don't remember eating. I don't remember any other activity than setting up in the hospital and just hoping. When I woke up Sunday, July 6th, my mom had told me that they decided to take Johnny off life support. He just continued to lose too much blood, and so he had passed away. I was pretty devastated because I was pretty sure that the doctors could fix him and that he would be okay. Me and Johnny was pretty close. And for my sister, I felt really terrible because they were going to get married August the 23rd. And it was just so much guilt that I took on at that time. I knew in the back of my mind that my mom had tried to talk to me about coming home and I wanted to stay there and party with them. My sister told me while we were waiting in the hospital that if I hadn't moved him, he wouldn't have lost so much blood. And so I took on a lot of guilt. I remember my sister having to call all the places that they had already reserved for their wedding to explain that he had passed away. I kind of felt like she was this young widow already. They hadn't even tied knots and she didn't have that opportunity. And I took that away from her. Several weeks right after it happened, I just remember walking around not feeling much of anything. I didn't want to talk about it, and it seemed like nobody approached me to talk about it. I think everybody didn't know what to say. So it was kind of like I was put out on an island. We went to Gary's funeral, and his sister came up and kind of wanted details of what happened. And I told her he was trying to help me. He was trying to help me out of the situation and that Forrest attacked him to get to me. After the funerals, I wanted to put it behind me, but in the same time, I didn't know how to move forward from something like that. I know that there was a couple of times that we would go to the cemetery and just drink at his graveside. Whenever your mind can't deal with such a traumatic event, it just kind of shuts down. It just got too hurtful to think of him in the ground and me still alive. I couldn't understand the meaning in it. You know, here I was, a person that walked around thinking of suicide all the time, and I was the one saved. In September, I found out I was pregnant. And, you know, I was thankful at that time that I hadn't been raped. And so this baby was not a product of that event. So I felt like there is some reason in the universe that I was given this opportunity, I guess, because I saw it as a new start. It was a chance to move from this horrible traumatic event and into something good. You know, I had somebody else that now I was going to be taken care of, something else big that I could deal with. At the point, I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I felt like this was a good chance to change who I was. I wanted to become someone else. I was probably about 3 months along. I knew it was Johnny's friend, David. And in the back of my mind, I thought this would mean a lot to Johnny. Me being with his friend, David, who he set me up with at one time, and I know it would just mean a lot to him. I told him, I am 3 months pregnant with your child. He just broke down and got all emotional, and he said, well, I'll help you. We can raise this child together. So we got a little apartment and started our life together. I had a baby girl, my first child, and I was amazed and overwhelmed all at the same time. Having this baby, it made me grow up. It kind of helped me become more responsible. I did go back to work with my mom at a microfilm company. I felt like I was accomplishing something good. I felt like I was taking care of her and I was doing something good for once in my life.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Around 1989, I found out that I was pregnant again. My husband was a drinker, and he also smoked pot. We fought, and there was times when we got along great, but there was a couple of really good fights that we had that he managed to bruise me in a couple places. He blackened my eye one time. I left and I went to my mom's, and then the next day my mom would drive me back with baby in tow. I had anger issues, and they would usually surface whenever drinking. I had a lot of anxiety. I started feeling just really disconnected. I struggle with my thoughts. I can remember having panic attacks. I think I was at the bank, and I had just pulled up in my car, and I just froze because this person was standing up close to the entrance of the bank on the stairs, and he looked pretty similar to Forrest. And at this time, Forrest had not been found. He was still on the run. I didn't know if it was him or if it was somebody that looked like him, but I remember just panicking and not being able to move out of my car and just waiting until he left. I couldn't move. I really didn't notice my panic attacks until 1990 that I realized I was having anxiety and panic attacks. They caught Forrest up in Virginia in 1989, and I had to go to court. I was the sole witness of these two murders, and I had to remember everything that happened that morning 3 years later, and that was such a struggle for me. A lot of the memories that I had from that time and before, I just shut out. I completely shut out anything that was painful. It was soon after Johnny's funeral that my sister kind of got hooked up with Thomas. A lot of Johnny's friends at the time ridiculed her for being with somebody so soon after Johnny was, you know, put in the ground. A lot of things were said that were mean. And I just thought at the time, like, you don't know how a person is going to cope with this. And she needed some kind of comfort. Our relationship was kind of strained, But as long as we were drinking, we had a great time. We could talk, we could party, we could cry about Johnny if he came up in conversation. But we tried not to think too much back because it was just too painful for both of us. Once her and Thomas fell apart, me and David started fighting quite a bit. One day, we had had a huge fight, and I left with the kids. We went to my mom's, and I sat over there for a little bit. And whenever I thought everything had cooled off, I went back home, and every stitch of my clothing was thrown up against the front door. I couldn't even get in. He had totally emptied my closet and just thrown everything up against the front door. I was not happy. I felt like trying to move toward sobriety, trying to move toward that fresh start. So I applied for a city job where I would be working in the permits department. You know, nobody knew my past. Nobody knew what bad things I had done, what I had come from. So I was pretty happy there. I had become friends with a certain plumbing contractor over the phone. So we decided to meet up and just talk and have coffee. I had somebody who would listen to me, somebody who I could be anybody with. There was a time after work that we had met up and I had gotten into his car and we were sitting there talking and he leaned over to kiss me. And the next thing I know, my husband is jerking his car door open and pulling him out. And this whole time, I look over and my son is standing at the front of the car, bawling his eyes out. And I thought, he's witnessed all of this. My husband, after, you know, yelling and cussing, he grabs my son, hauls him back to the car, and screeches out of there. By the time I got home, he was already packing his stuff and loading up his car to leave. I knew that I had crossed a line, but I was also relieved that this was the answer to get out of my bad marriage. And it worked. It was an escape from everything that connected me to Johnny. This was another way for me to get rid of that part that I didn't want to belong to anymore. As soon as David moved out, I felt free for the first time in a long time. My sobriety happened shortly after the divorce. In my mind, I kept on moving forward to this fresh start. It meant that I had to face some of the things that I hadn't dealt with. After I got clean, I wasn't dealing with as much anxiety. I felt more clear-minded, that I could think better. I started seeing a therapist. I started diving into working out, going to the gym. I hadn't worked out in a couple of years, and, you know, I figured that I would take up running. I would just run, and I would pray, and I would talk to God, and I would mostly wrestle with things that I didn't understand, like, why did I have to go through with this? Why did you give me a father that was abusive and that was very distant, didn't love me? I wrestled with, does God love me? There wasn't a whole lot of answers that I got back, but it just felt like God was teaching me to pray, teaching me to surrender. In this time that I was running, I thought I was just exercising, and I was actually learning to surrender to God. He was literally ripping everything from me. the guilt and just the pain of remembering these things that I had held so tightly onto that was not beneficial for my spiritual growth. I remember at those times that there was a lot of anger that surfaced, and a lot of it came up of my dad. I would just question God about giving me a family, a father that was so angry, that was so hateful and abusive. Questioning God about, you know, who he makes your parents. Didn't get a lot of answers, but I got healing. I received his peace. You know, we're not going to have the answers on this side, but we can have peace. After I had my daughter in 2007, I'm starting a new family with a new husband, and I had my second set of kids. There were a lot of things that were resurfacing for me. I didn't know really honestly what was going on, if it was postpartum depression. I just know that I had a lot of baggage and that I had started drinking again. I didn't want to repeat those old habits. I knew I needed to get reconnected into church, and I absolutely fell in love with the church. I liked the pastor, met several people that were just really nice and welcoming. So I felt like this was a church that we could really connect to. And that's also where I found the Christian counseling. They had a place called the Hope Center. So, you know, I got this new fire and I wanted to start serving, wanted to work in the church, do whatever I could to be involved and to be included in this church. The Christian counseling was also very helpful because I'm getting this introduction to this whole new world where people were accepting and friendly and just part of the body of Christ. And it was a great feeling. I had to forgive things that were in my past. One of the hardest truths for me in all of this is that we all fall short of the glory of God. We're all broken. I have done a lot of things through my life that I have hurt other people. Maybe I have not even recognized it. I know I hurt my sister. I've hurt my mom for some of the things that I used to do after she divorced my dad. I put her through all kinds of hell. Knowing that we are all broken and that we all commit sin in our lives, hurting other people, I think it's easy to forgive other people when you think, I would want to be forgiven. The first time that I was actually thinking over what I would say to him face to face, it just became very easy for me to say, Forrest, I forgive you, and know that he's fighting his demons too. We found out some things about him while we were having to testify in court. He came up in a broken family. His father was also very abusive. So he didn't have a good start either. I just keep on thinking that our reality is that we are in a very broken world. I felt the same way about my dad. Even if I didn't personally, face to face, tell him that I forgived him for all of these things, God knew my heart. And so it was more for me than it was them. It was a freedom that I would feel even if they didn't know. And it is such a release, and it is such a weight taken off of your shoulders whenever you are able to let go of those past hurts. I struggled forgiving myself for a very long time. In fact, I held on to some of the things that I wasn't getting answers for, and I didn't realize that I was still carrying that weight. I know that I buried a lot of that stuff that happened to me early on. And I would just say, don't wait so long to seek some kind of help. Time isn't always a healer. Years and years can go by and you're still going to feel that trauma. Shortly after it happened, sometimes it felt like it was just that day or the day before. It took a long time for me to be able to move away from that. I was walking with a friend one day, and I had kind of told her over not full details, but what had happened that morning. And she told me, she said, "Well, honey, it's not your fault what happened with Johnny." There was a little detail that we found out whenever we went to court and was testifying that he had planted knives all over the house. Forrest was planted there. He had a plan in mind to take somebody. It doesn't make sense that Johnny would have passed away anyway, but if I hadn't been there, it might have been Holly. Either it was me or my sister. I can actually count myself blessed that I am a survivor, that I didn't let this thing be the end of me. I am a new creation, and this doesn't identify me. None of my past is what identifies me today. I think the hardest part for me has been how it has affected everybody that was involved. I mean, nobody walked away unscathed. My sister especially. I was able to pick myself up out of the ashes and dust myself off. But I somehow feel like I kind of left her. I feel like she didn't want to move away from that one day. I think as much as I've changed, I wish we were closer, that she would be able to see the person. I'm sorry. That she would be able to see the person I am, that it would encourage her to do the same. I know that God has his timing for everything. I just wish it hadn't taken me so long. It wasn't an overnight process. It was many, many years. I don't have all of the answers that I need, but it was well worth it because I have actually changed to a person that I can feel good about.
Today's episode featured Haley Ross. If you'd like to reach out to Haley, you can contact her at kattannie@yahoo.com. That's kattannie@yahoo.com. From Wondery, you're listening to This Is Actually Happening. If you love what we do, please rate and review the show. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. You can also join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us bring you our shows for free. I'm your host, Whit Misseldine. Today's episode was co-produced by me and Andrew Waits, with special thanks to the This Is Actually Happening team, including Ellen Westberg. The intro music features the song Ilabai by Tipper. You can join the This Is Actually Happening community on the discussion group on Facebook or at Actually Happening on Instagram. On the show's website, thisisactuallyhappening.com, you can find out more about the podcast, contact us with any questions, submit your own story, or visit the store, where you can find This Is Actually Happening designs on stickers, t-shirts, wall art, hoodies, and more. That's thisisactuallyhappening.com.
And finally, if you'd like to become an ongoing supporter of what we do, go to patreon.com/happening. Even $2 to $5 a month goes a long way to support our vision. Thank you for listening.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to This Is Actually Happening ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.